Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Dr. Carrie Sampson, who is an associate professor in the Division of Educational Leadership and Innovation at Arizona State University. Her scholarship focuses on how educational leadership and policymaking at the K-12 level influences equity and social justice for minoritized youth and their families. In this month's podcast, Dr. Sampson discusses the role of school boards in educational policymaking, and she helps us understand both the challenges and opportunities that school boards have to create equitable and just learning environments for students. As always, we hope this podcast is interesting and helpful. So for listeners who may not be familiar with the process of educational policymaking in the United States, what is the role of school boards?
Well, technically, they're the local governing body that provides oversight and governance over our public schools, particularly over public school districts. And, you know, that's the technical answer. Most people see their responsibilities as hiring and firing and managing the superintendent, you know, approving or not approving budgets, you know, being part of some of the decision making around curriculum and teacher pay, administrator pay, et cetera. They're really also supposed to be representatives, especially elected. And usually they're elected, sometimes they're appointed, but representatives of their local community around decisions for public education and public schools. I really think that one of the most essential purposes of the school board is to create a link between the school district and the community that they're serving. And so they don't always do that, but I think that that's, you know, one of the biggest purposes of that.
What kinds of differences exist in terms of the design or operation of school boards around the country?
Yeah, that's really interesting because I'm fascinated at the fact that we have so many different types of school boards operating throughout the United States. And it really is dependent usually around, you know, state policy and state law. But most school boards are elected, some are appointed, some are hybrid, where they have a mix of elected and appointed school board members. They vary in size, usually between 5 school board members and 7, but there's places where there's like, you know, 9, 10, 12 school board members. Some are elected at ward, and some are elected at large. So at ward, you know, it'd be a smaller community within that school district. Has a school board representative that they, you know, elect, and then other districts where they elect all 5 or 7 school board members are involved and, you know, and folks can elect all of those folks. Some govern really large school districts, like a lot of urban school districts where you're governing, you know, 300,000 students. And others are more rural, small school board, you know, school districts where, you know, you have a couple schools, maybe even just one school. And so that changes, I think, how school boards operate in the U.S. And some are most school boards are nonpartisan. Some actually are elected across partisan lines. So they'll run on a ticket with Republicans or Democrats or independents. Again, most are nonpartisan, but I think states are shifting that as well.
How have school boards changed over time, if at all?
It's gone through waves, and I think the first evolution of school boards were, you know, really run like community councils, large community councils, where they governed, you know, maybe 1 or 2 schools in that community. They had about 20 school board members on average at that point, you know, and then it shifted to where you have about 7 and, you know, we used to have in the early 1900s, like hundreds of thousands of school districts. There was about 120,000 school districts that served an average of 200 students. And now we're talking 13,000 school districts around that are serving about 3,500 students. So it's a much different operation. And school boards were, you know, the funding differences have changed as well. It used to be where school districts were funded, you know, 80% of that funding came from local sources. And so school boards, you know, had a lot more power and authority in terms of the resources that were provided to schools and what that meant for schools. And so now we're talking about 40 to 50% of funding is local and the rest is state and a little bit federal funding. So that also shifts. the way that school boards kind of operate and what they're governing over.
In terms of thinking about the idea of local control, I was going to ask you, how do school boards protect themselves from more activist leaders who want to influence issues of curriculum and issues of school safety and teacher pay? And I still want to ask you that. But I wonder if maybe you have any thoughts on how the issue of local control has been treated over time when you think about things like segregation and then the interventions now that are happening for political reasons, ideological reasons around quote unquote, like things like wokeness. I wonder if you have any thoughts on the idea of local control, how we've intervened in school districts and maybe how that's changed over time.
Well, I came to this work around school boards from researching school desegregation in Nevada. And one thing it became very clear to me that while the courts mandated the Clark County School District to desegregate its schools, it was the school board that made the decision on how the district would desegregate those schools. And the decision that they made placed a heavy burden on Black students and their families for over 20 years, where, you know, these Black students and their families had to be bused out of their neighborhood for 11 of the 12 years of their schooling. And it was just highly, highly inequitable. And I looked at, I started to examine, you know, how that decision was made, who made that, you know, like who was on the school board at the time. And at that time, I mean, it was early 1960s, there were 7 people, 6 of them were white men, 1 white woman. And, you know, the Black community was very clear about, like, we want a more equitable plan to desegregate schools. This is not equitable. But that voice was not heard, you know, by that school board. And so until the 1990s, when activists, Black families, mostly Black mothers, went to the school board and said, you know what, we're tired of this plan. We want our kids to go to neighborhood schools. Like, we, you know, this is not fair. You know, this is not good for our community, our families. And they threatened to pull their kids out during funding day. And finally the district, I mean, after, you know, pushing and advocating a lot, and then finally the district decided to roll back the plan and do something more equitable. But again, that was a lot of push and pull, and the board had a lot of say over that. And so I think that it's complex, right? Like I think that school boards are really important. I think that they should have, there should be some authority and governing authority at the local level of our schools. And at the same time, we need to have checks and balances in place. Where, you know, courts can intervene, where, you know, we can consider how we're electing school boards. So in Clark County, they actually shifted from at-large to at-ward elections after that, too, to make sure that they could have more equitable representation at the board level. And so there was, they were able to then elect a Black school board member. And since then, it's shifted a lot. And the decisions that are being made are shifting a lot, right? And so having that voice, having the ability to elect different board members, you know, and also having really strong state laws in place and being able to rely on U.S. Constitution and state constitutions, I think is important. So there's a balance between, representing communities, right? And also ensuring that all children are educated equitably and fairly. And can school boards find that balance? You know, I think that's the question. And, you know, I think that's what I think we're grappling with here.
Are there formal strategies in place for school boards to try to attend to the diversity of the stakeholder groups within their districts?
Not most school boards, I would say. Some do. Some, I think, practice regular town hall meetings with their community members. You know, of course, school board meetings have become that center of the practice of where they hear community voices. So unless they have other alternative, you know, strategies outside of school board meetings, so school board, that, and that's part of the reason why school board meetings have become so politicized, And because it's one of the few public spaces where folks can come and make formal remarks and have, you know, their voices formally heard and documented. So there are not a lot of school boards though that are offering and practicing other strategies. So, you know, their school board members, you know, some will regularly meet with constituents. You know, constituents can email school board members or, you know, submit a comment, but unless, you know, and some of the most effective school boards I've seen have strategic plans that have been really highly informed by community members, by families, by youth, by, you know, their teachers, and they use that plan as a way, and they, there's constant follow-up and check-ins with those stakeholders. That is a strategy. And based on some of the work I've done, one of the implications and recommendations that my colleague and I made was that there needs to be an additional formal and transparent process for school board members to hear community voices so that they, you know, it's not just school board meetings, but, you know, perhaps, and who can even go to school board meetings? That's the other thing, is that it excludes a whole series of people. You know, the single mom who, okay, at 6 p.m. on a Wednesday, you're going to be dragging your kids to a school board meeting to, you know, have a voice on an issue. Like, is that a feasible option for everybody? No.
What other kind of practices, like what other, so I asked you about the if there were formal ways to like open up opportunities for equity and justice, but are there formal rules on the books that limit it? Like the scheduling of meetings?
Yeah, I mean, and that's often state law. I mean, it's state laws are kind of general too about school board meetings. They'll say, okay, you need to have, you know, X number of meetings per month. In terms of time, you know, usually that's up to local districts, time and date, and how they're meeting, right, is also sometimes up to local district. I think one thing we saw in COVID is the shift to virtual meetings. Opened up kind of a different level of who can attend and who can't. And some of that made things more complicated and some, you know, but it also offered, you know, folks who hadn't been able to attend a school board meeting or didn't really know about it, an opportunity to be part of that. But yes, I mean, and then we have rules like that can be enforced, and sometimes they're enforced and sometimes they're not. And, you know, there was in terms of public comment, a lot of school board meetings did not have rules necessarily in place until, you know, a series of people came to those public comments. And then all of a sudden they institute, you know, maybe a 2-minute limit or a 3-minute limit. And that has become a heavily used practice, better or for worse, you know, sometimes I think it's inequitable how it's being enforced. And other times, you know, it becomes a necessary tool to, you know, provide or operate an efficient meeting. But again, it speaks to the fact that, you know, this should not be the only space and place where community concerns are heard about education.
When you think about, you mentioned that some policies over time have come to be influenced by groups that were historically marginalized, whether it's racially minoritized groups or youth. So in your work, what kinds of strategies have you found that these groups use to disrupt the policies that are in place?
Well, I think, I mean, I've seen a lot of organizing around school board meetings among like minoritized communities. Where, you know, folks will gather community leaders, families, youth to school board meetings to share compelling stories of what's going on, compelling stories around inequities that have happened in their schools, you know, racism that has, you know, really disrupted students' educational experiences. I've seen folks speak at the podium, not only to the board, but like to the full audience and those people who they know are watching on the YouTube video or whatever. And also to the media who they've invited to these school board meetings to make sure that this is a very, you know, that we're not just trying to tell this story or convince just the board, but everyone in the room that this is an issue and that this needs to be addressed. Especially when a district is not responsive to a lot of these inequities that are going on in schools. I've seen folks practice civil disobedience where they go beyond the 3-minute limit or whatever limit is there and say, you know what, you're not listening to, especially after they've been ignored over a series of meetings, you know, and they'll say, okay, you know what, I'm going to keep going. And I'm going to this is explicitly civil disobedience because you're not hearing me. You're not hearing us. And I've seen folks organize to elect new school board members, and develop coalitions, you know, beyond just that school district, you know, other neighboring school districts, so that they can, you know, push these policies around equity, not just to one or two schools, but the full community. I've also seen, you know, sadly, like, I think there's been some exhaustion around this advocacy, and some folks are like, you know, I'm tired and we're going to do our own thing, you know, and this is where, and it's, you know, they've given up kind of on this traditional public schooling because they're not being heard. And so I've seen some of that too, which is sad and concerning. But at the same time, it's understandable where if a district is not responsive at some point, you know, there's folks who will go off and create their own schools. And so, you know, I've seen other hands of that though, where, you know, districts are responsive and they create, you know, policies. They hire folks who can do some good equity work in the district, but it seems like it ebbs and flows. And then you have a new board or you have a new superintendent. And so again, it becomes complicated and it requires, you know, a constant community organizing around these issues. And a pipeline of school board members who are committed to advancing equity. And I think that's important.
Yeah. So let me ask you about that too. So you mentioned that part of the organizing efforts have been to elect school board members. I imagine that over time that this has meant that the diversity on school boards has shifted. You mentioned in Clark County when you did your work originally in your dissertation around segregation that it was a board that was all white. I imagine in a lot of communities, especially large urban districts now, there are school board members of color, maybe indigenous people, more black school board members. When you think about the kind of rise in anti-CRT laws that are coming and the very aggressive sort of activists that are coming and just yelling at school board members, singling out perhaps more often than most these school board members of color. And you think about that you want there to be a healthy pipeline of people who want to be school board members. Do we know anything about the experiences of these school board members in the last few years?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one project I'm doing currently is a project on school board members who identify as Black, Indigenous, folks of color, Latinx. And I've interviewed about 35 school board members across the country about their experiences and perspectives. And it's varied quite a bit. And in states that are generally more conservative, red states, it's been really a tough experience for a lot of them. They've talked about even just campaigning and how the campaigning process in some of these school districts was really tough. One Black school board member, a female, she's like, you know, she was critiqued a lot by the media, called a, you know, welfare mother. And when she went door to door, it was in her first run was like 2016. And one of her supporters, an 80-year-old white woman, said, you know what, I'm going to put my shoes on and go with you because this is a Trump neighborhood and I'm afraid you're going to get hurt. So I want to make sure you're safe. And she walked through that neighborhood with her But these are the types of things where she was constantly scrutinized, threatened, harassed. A couple of other board members have been, you know, death threats, where they had to hire security, to watch their home. And eventually, I mean, a couple of them have resigned because they're like, or decided, I can't, I'm not running again because this is too much for me and my family. And yet, these are some of kind of the more extreme cases, but I think they're the case that, you know, we need to hear that and be able to understand what folks are going through in these positions, especially if they're one or two, you know, board members of color on a board, you know, that it, you know, is in a suburban district, that kind of thing. It's a little different when you're in like an urban, mostly, you know, a school district that's serving, you know, very urban, mostly school students of color. I think that they've had a different experience, you know, and there's other challenges there, I think, in terms of like pushing equity at the board and kind of, you know, addressing a lot of these anti-CRT efforts. But yeah, I think that it's definitely a position that, you know, we want to have these healthy pipelines, but they're often unpaid, not supported well. There's a lack of training. And even when the National, I don't know if you know about the National School Board Association, when they put out the letter asking for federal support to protect school board members and other educators who were being threatened and harassed, there was so much pushback. And now their National School Board Association has dealt with about 25 states withdrawing their membership. And they had to kind of retract their whole statement, even though this harassment was real and these school board members and educators needed support. And so, you know, again, this is a really complicated situation where, and this is one of the few, you know, organizations that are there to support school board members and offer, you know, training. And yet now they've had to kind of, they felt the need to retract that support because of state, you know, other state legislatures who have critiqued and pushed back against, you know, that effort. And so, yeah, I mean, we're dealing with a lot of lone school board members of color who don't necessarily have protection and support that they need, that they should have in these positions.
When you think about the implications of a dwindling number of school board members of color, what does that mean for schools and for kids?
I think that we're then dealing with a lack of representation and the fact that we have less and less folks who are kind of willing to champion a very humanizing, you know, equitable educational experience for our students. And that's concerning and it's scary. And, you know, it should be on everyone's radar. I do, from my research, I know that it's often school board members of color who are leading equity efforts in their school districts. And I think given the fact that we have a student population that's more than 50% non-white students, and yet school board of the school board members, 80% identify as white. It's similar to the argument for diversifying the teacher workforce and the principal workforce. I think it's really important that we consider how we can diversify our school board membership. And really these folks are people who kind of bring their lived experiences to this position. Having dealt with race and racism, experienced it firsthand, seeing and experiencing what that means as folks of color in school, you know, with their family members, as parents of color. And I think they bring a valuable and unique experience and perspective to a school board. And what I've seen in my research, they're often the ones that are pushing the school district to address issues of inequity. And they're often the folks who community members of color feel comfortable coming to when their child, you know, particularly parents, when their children are experiencing racism and schools are not responsive. And so they really are that, you know, often are that link around equity between the school district and the community. And so I think it's really important for us to think about how do we usher in and support school board members whose experiences mirror communities, and how do we, you know, make sure that they have the tools and resources they need to do the work that we need to see in our schools in terms of equity.
What sorts of things are you seeing happening now, or would you like to see in terms of supporting school boards be these local beacons of democracy, and to be able to be an institution for communities that are going to address the needs of a diverse set of student educational needs?
I mean, I'll talk about some things I've seen here in Arizona. There's an organization that I'm working with that's mostly made up of educators and parents. And they've started to really watch school boards. School boards are becoming part of their radar a lot more lately. But they've kind of divvied out different regions of the state and said, okay, here we're going to be part of watching, like, everyone's going to either attend a school board meeting in this district or in this district. And every week they'll like designate, okay, we're, you know, so that we are watching what's happening at these school board meetings, what's on the agenda, what's getting pushed, and, you know, paying attention to issues of inequity and equity, and that, you know, they can come back to the fuller group. Here's what's going on at this district. You know, we need to show up there at the next meeting, and we need to talk about, you know, we need to be able to, you know, make public comments and push the school board to, you know, school boards are generally pretty reactive. And that's one thing I found in my research. You know, they either kind of just go with the flow with the superintendent, or they're reacting to public comments, they're reacting to state law. And so, you know, knowing that, like, how can communities be involved in kind of pushing school boards to react? And how can school board members, if, you know, if there's school board members who are championing equity, how can they be proactively reactive, you know? How can they prepare for, you know, the reactions of the community around issues? And it really is like little changes. I mean, school boards aren't making usually these huge curricular changes or whatever, but, you know, maybe it is like providing support for a dual language school, or, you know, providing funding for high quality professional development. It's usually small things, right? But, you know, and there are organizations who are working to create pipelines. There's, you know, an organization here in Arizona called All in Education. They started working with parents to like educate parents around issues, but then they realized these parents and other community members can be school board members. And so they recently created a program called Lista, that is working to with, you know, former school board members to train folks into the position of a school board, and to get them on these boards so that they're representing our children, you know, particularly minoritized children. I say our children because, you know, my kids, 7 and 10, are in these schools, and you know, I'm also, you know, going to bat with school board members and having, you know, like developing relationships with these school board members on behalf of my children, and not just my children, but all these children, you know, around issues of equity. And so I think it's all of our jobs as parents, as community members, as scholars, to like pay attention to what's going on at the local level, and support folks who are have the knowledge, the, you know, training, and the, you know, equity focus to get on these boards. It's also important that we pay attention to state politics. And, you know, I've written a paper about the power of the state and how local districts and school boards have kind of navigated some of these really inequitable policies that are dealt from the state level, or resisted them. But I mean, we in Arizona is, again, a perfect example of, we had, you know, the state law that banned ethnic studies and dismantled the Mexican American Studies program at the local level. And it took years for that local district. I mean, first of all, the school board made the ultimate choice, but the state said, you know, we're going to withdraw millions of dollars in funding if you don't dismantle Mexican American Studies program. And that anti-ethnic studies law was targeting that program at Tucson, TUSD, Tucson Unified School District. So the school board ultimately made that decision to dismantle. It was not a unanimous decision. I think it was like 5-3-2 decision. And, you know, it dismantled so much equity work that had been done that had, you know, was proven to be academically positive for so many students in that school district. And it took years of funding and time for that local school district to push back at the state or in the courts. And the law was shown to be racist, you know, years later after the dismantling of the program. And so, you know, these state laws are really, can be really detrimental for local school districts and for equity work in particular. And so I think it is really important that districts constantly and, you know, community members, that we constantly stay on top of what is happening at the state level and folks in those positions, not just the governor, but the state legislature. What is their education agenda? How do we make sure that they're supporting a public and equitable education system? And, you know, I think that can help prevent a lot of work on the back end in terms of kind of advancing equity.
Thank you, Dr. Sampson, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweet.